And now Jill Bevilacqua presents episode 7 of The Vatican Centuries, our dramatisation of the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican.
The old-time religion was dead and buried. After Constantine, it was some time before Christianity was anything more than tolerated.
Julian the Apostate even tried to put the clock back and reinstate paganism, but he was unsuccessful.
In 391, the Emperor Theodosius finally prohibited heathen cults altogether, making the Christian faith officially the religion of the Roman state.
It is our will that all the peoples we rule should practice that religion which the divine Peter the Apostle transmitted to the Romans. We shall believe in the single deity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit under the concept of equal majesty and of the Holy Trinity. We command that those persons who follow this rule shall embrace the name of Catholic Christians. The rest, however, whom we adjudge demented and insane, shall sustain the infamy of heretical dogmas. Their meeting places shall not receive the name of churches, and they shall be smitten first by divine vengeance and secondly by the retribution of our own initiative, which we shall assume in accordance with divine judgment.
St. Peter's was a reality, as a church and as a place of pilgrimage. But it was also a building which had arisen over a massive pagan cemetery, and only half a century after the construction was completed, the crypts beneath the floor of the basilica became flooded. The streams from the Vatican Hill had filtered down through the foundations into the tombs.
Pope Damasus I, who reigned from 366 to 384, was undismayed. He drained the hillside, managing to block the source of one of the springs, and collected the water into a subterranean basin. Two pipes drew water from this basin. One supplied the baptismal font which Damasus had built, the other flowed into the fountain, which the Pope had placed in the centre of the portico for the refreshment of pilgrims.
This fountain was a splendid affair. It consisted of a large pine cone made of bronze planted on a solid base. Water poured plentifully from its leaves and summit, and rose to quite a height before splashing down into a porphyry shell beneath. The fountain was surmounted by a bronze canopy of convex form with a cross in its centre and supported by 8 Corinthian pillars.
The baptistry built by Damasus was also surrounded by columns, probably like those of the Lateran baptistry which still exists. The chair of Peter stood in the baptistry, and here it was the bishop sat, waiting to confirm those who had just been baptised.
Pope Damasus was also responsible for putting the catacombs in order. They had fallen into disuse as places of worship now that Christians could freely build churches. Damasus was something of an archaeologist. He consolidated and enlarged the catacombs, and as he found and identified the various tombs of the martyrs, he labelled them with poetic epigraphs.
In the first centuries of the church, the Bishop of Rome was in no sense a pope, as we know popes. Even the title, Papa, was not used until the end of the 4th century, and not until the 6th century was it officially reserved for the Bishop of Rome.
The early popes were fairly shadowy figures, reacting to events but not shaping the new relationships between church and imperial government. It was under the Emperor Theodosius that a churchman first stood up to the lay power and attempted a definition of the relation of church and state. That man was Ambrose.
In the year 374, the Bishop of Milan had just died, and the people were gathered in the cathedral to elect a successor. The majority of Milanese were Catholics, but there was a strong minority of Arians. Discussion became heated and tempers flared. At the height of the uproar, a man entered the church and calmed the crowd. It was Ambrose, the governor of Liguria and Emilia, and a very popular figure. Soon the cry was heard, "Ambrose for bishop!" and it was taken up by the whole assembly.
Ambrose, who was only a catechumen, was reluctant. But the emperor upheld his nomination, and within a week he had been baptized, ordained, and consecrated bishop. He proved to be one of the greatest and most beloved pastors of all time. His people were ready to die for him. When the Empress Justina insisted that Arians be admitted to the churches, Ambrose refused point blank. Justina sent the Imperial Guard to see that her order was carried out. Together with the faithful, Ambrose shut himself in the cathedral, now surrounded by soldiers. The siege went on for several days, but Ambrose was unperturbed. To keep the people's spirits up, he taught them to sing.
Emperors found Ambrose a hard nut to crack. Valentinian condemned him to exile, but he ignored the order. Theodosius crossed swords with him more than once. When he did not receive the bishop, Ambrose took pen and ink and wrote, "I'm writing to you so that you will listen to me in your palace. Otherwise, I will see that I'm listened to in my church."
And he was. When Theodosius suppressed a rebellion in Thessalonica by executing 7,000 people, Ambrose forced him to do public penance before admitting him to the cathedral. "The emperor is in the church, not above the church," said Ambrose.
Ambrose was never pope, but he acted like one. And perhaps that is why even to this day, the Diocese of Milan is second only to that of Rome.
Physically, Ambrose was small and delicate in health, with an aquiline nose and piercing eyes. But intellectually, there was nothing small about him. And like most truly great men, he found time for everyone. Indeed, St. Augustine, who was eventually baptized by him, grumbled that he was unable to get close enough to the bishop to pour out his heart for the troops of men full of business to whose infirmities he condescended.
"He did not forbid any man to enter," writes Augustine, "nor was it his custom to be told beforehand of such as came to speak with him." Augustine never became really intimate with Ambrose, but he attended his sermons regularly, and it was largely due to the teaching of the Greek bishop that he was finally won over to Christianity.
Both men would later be declared doctors of the Latin Church, even though, as so often happens, history has reserved to the pupil a greater glory than that of the master. As the power of the empire waned, the importance of Christian Rome grew. The shrines of Peter and Paul were drawing more and more pilgrims. And on the 29th of June each year, the Feast of the Two Apostles was marked by a solemn procession round the city, from St. Peter's to St. Paul's. The 4th century Spanish poet Prudentius made a pilgrimage to Rome and describes the atmosphere of the festival.
"An extraordinary crowd, festive, rushing. Why, my friend, is it wandering through the city, filling it with clamour and jubilation? Here we are once again at the day of the Apostles' triumph. Watch the throngs of Romans in the city squares, some going one way, some another. There are really two feasts, but the joy is one."
And Jill Bevilacqua will be back at this same time next week with episode 8 of The Vatican Centuries.